Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Adam Gonzalez. He is the Director of Behavioral Health and the Mind-Body Clinical Research Center at Stony Brook. Adam, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So for the benefit of the listeners, I always start out with this. If you could, share a little bit of your background and how you've arrived at this role so that people get a sense of you.
Sure thing. I'm a clinical psychologist focusing on mind-body medicine, which really deals with how we can best manage stress and improve overall well-being. So looking at healthy lifestyle behaviors, looking at different techniques like mindfulness-based practice, relaxation strategies. I have been doing clinical research in the area of stress management and resilience over the just under 10 years now, looking at different groups of individuals in need of services, including high-functioning individuals that are under stress, as well as people who are suffering with conditions like PTSD and respiratory distress, Parkinson's disease. So it's a great need to address mental health and overall well-being. So at Stony Brook, as you mentioned, the director of the Mind Body Center, which we started in 2015, and that has really grown nicely to be able to provide services to patients from the community as well as to our employees at the hospital.
So a couple of things in there that are kind of interesting. I don't think I've ever heard the term high functioning relative to stress, but it sounds like that's maybe the role that many of us have. We sort of muddle through, but we're not really coping. Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, I was actually referring to, we just finished up recently a research project, a grant that we received from NASA to look at different ways to provide mental health treatment for long duration space missions. So we, for that study, we had to recruit astronaut-like adults. So we were focusing on individuals who had advanced degrees, mostly in the medical field from academic medical centers, who were under work-related stress that was interfering in their life. So very, very relevant to what we're talking about today in terms of employees' mental health in the hospitals and among our healthcare workers.
Right. So when you talk about high functioning, it's the relationship between sort of academic, high-level sort of roles, but essentially lack of demonstrated stress-related symptoms that they're dealing with? Is that what's going on there?
Yes, I would say so. I like to think about mental health in terms of stress and stress reactivity, the experience of stress, and then how that goes on to impact our overall functioning, both in our personal lives, at work. And I talk about it in terms of stress and as a way to help destigmatize mental health problems. There's still very much a stigma associated with talking about mental health and mental health treatment. And in reality, we all experience stress to different degrees and have different coping resources that allow us to deal well with the stressors, or there are times where it gets so overwhelming where we then experience distress. You might see anxiety problems, depression, even suicide ideation, and other conditions start popping up then.
Yeah, it's funny. As I'm listening to you, there's a part of me that can almost hear my meditation in the morning coming from you as you talk about the way that we cope and the fact that stress is this external factor and how we deal with it is actually more important. So I'm almost falling into a meditation zone here with you, which is delightful.
Yeah. We do a lot of meditation work and eliciting in the relaxation response, relaxation training with the end goal of trying to increase our our capacity for managing stress to also increase our overall level of resilience. So the more that we can beef up our coping abilities and get our body used to being in that relaxation response and triggering that response, the better able we may be able to deal with those intense stressful situations.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, of the things that I regret in my life, not starting meditation when I was much younger and not starting yoga is two things that I think would have had a huge positive impact. And I suspect you've probably got some similar views. Going back to the Mind-Body Clinical Research Center, so it's been around for 5 years. To me, that sounds like an unusual thing. It's certainly not something that I hear about a lot in facilities. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of that, how that came to be.
Sure. I've had a lot of great models for clinical research centers where there's the integration of both providing clinical services to patients while also collecting outcome data, which is a part of more evidence-based practice, seeing how our patients are doing as they're going through our therapies to make sure that they're improving. And if they're not, to reevaluate what our practices look like to help the patients get on a successful course. So we're able to then use that data for research purposes to evaluate our treatments, understand why and how our treatments work, and then also the incorporation of trainees into the center. So there are three main areas of focus, including the clinical services research, and then also having psychology trainees integrated into the center to train our future clinical researchers. So we have a number of different training programs, like an externship, an internship, a postdoctoral training program. And at the core is really trying to provide the best care to patients. So we have a number of different group-based services, stress management program, dialectical behavior therapy, weight management services, and then your standard individual cognitive behavioral therapy services as well.
So as this center formed and you started to build out these services, can you share a little bit of the sort of experiences and any insights in setting that up that others could learn from that sort of helped you along the way? If you look back and you went, gosh, I wish we'd known that, or, you know, that was a very significant sort of insight that helped expand the capabilities and deliver more value in the center.
I always have the eye on collaboration and trying to work with others to meet their needs and also to see how we can provide the most care to the most people, best care to the most people. And so the genuine networking has been really important to really see how the work that we're doing can connect with other practices, especially other medical practices. So as one example, expanding to working with patients with Parkinson's disease and their caregivers, which that grew out of some conversations and talks with neurologists to see, look, there's this need in this patient population. So really being open to working with other disciplines, other providers to see where those needs are in the community.
Obviously, a reasonable period of time you've set this up, and fast forward to 2020, and who would have guessed what was going to happen? And we're now suddenly in this sort of pandemic crisis. And if there was anything that I got from the impact of that, the overwhelming nature of mental, not just to the clinicians, but literally across the board, seems enormous. Tell us a little bit about what happened in your world and how you responded.
Well, as COVID started spreading and cases started increasing, actually right before cases started spreading, we had convened a mental health team, a disaster mental health team at the hospital, a subgroup of us got together after our initial meeting to talk about how we can best take care of our providers and employees at the hospital. So we were anticipating that this is going to be a very high stress situation, had that potential for very high stress, which was the case eventually. So we started really immediately putting together services and brainstorming ideas for taking care of our employees. On the outpatient side for our community members, we quickly moved our services to telehealth platforms. And Stony Brook really did an amazing job in getting up our virtual platforms and getting those set up so that we can deliver telehealth services. So all of our mental health services on the outpatient side quickly transitioned to telehealth. And we maintain pretty heavy referral sources throughout COVID. And usually what happens during traumatic situations is that people are very heavily focused on the getting through that traumatic experience. And you see that demand for services when things start slowing down. And that's where we're at right now on the outpatient side. For our employees, we really worked on putting together resources in preparation of that height moment of stress. So some of those things that we've done, one of the most successful initiative was developing an employee respite area. So which was really led by our psychiatric nurses. So our psychiatric nurses had transformed a 10-bed pediatric unit into an employee respite area that was filled with snacks, beverages. We had coffee, tea, aromatherapy, soothing music, de-stress activities like adult coloring books and puzzles. Also having the availability of staff on the unit to provide one-to-one support for those employees that needed that support. So throughout the height of COVID, within around a four-month time period, we had just under 20,000 visits to that unit. So it was really a really high utilized space that employees really appreciated during the height of the pandemic.
So as you think back, I mean, clearly huge utilization, obviously positive experience, because otherwise people wouldn't be coming. Do you have any sense of the data that's coming out of that from the experiences, repeat use, some of the areas that were more helpful than others? You know, what were the insights that others can sort of benefit from?
Yeah, so occurring side by side with the respite area were several other initiatives that were really great learning opportunities. So having the telehealth platform, we were able to build out resources on that platform for employees as well. So we were using Microsoft Teams as our platform, and we developed a wellness champions channel on Teams that employees could access and see what resources were available in the local community, having coping skills posted to that channel that they could access, video messages. We also had a community messages of support channel. So we had, I think, over 500 messages that were sent in from children, students writing cards, also sending in video messages of support. That was another really great resource for our employees to have access to that. We were also able to print out and laminate a lot of those pictures, which adorned the walls of the hospital, and that also served as a great motivation for employees to keep going. The other virtual platform was a daily support group that we had set up, and we set up three support meetings a day at 8 a.m., 12 p.m., and 8 p.m., Monday to Friday. And what we found there is that although many employees signed up to be part of that team, there wasn't high utilization of those support groups. And some hypothesized reasons for that is that, one, as I mentioned before, during that height of trauma, people might not be at a place to want to engage in talking about their experiences, or perhaps even being in a group format and sharing what's going on when they're really at that high stress level. So what we did is we changed the name and our approach to a mindfulness meditation meeting. And so then we offered these mindfulness meditation meetings. And once we switched that focus, we had much greater utilization of that service compared to the support groups. So it may be the case that people were more likely or more desiring to participate in some brief exercises that they can do and not have to interact and share their feelings or their thoughts about what's going on while they're in this traumatic situation.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Adam Gonzalez. He's the Director of Behavioral Health and the Mind-Body Clinical Research Center at Stony Brook. We were just talking about the resilience room that you set up. It was a repurposed pediatric ward during the sort of crisis. I think, you know, some positive experiences around sharing of messages, I think, you know, just sounds like a really simple thing. I'm not talking technically, but, you know, just from a conceptual standpoint, we get these positive messages, but who sees them apart from the person that opens the envelope or, you know, wherever? And you set up a channel, albeit electronic, but also physical, that shared some of that. And then I think really interesting, and it goes back to the point that you made, is this stigma that's attached to mental health. And you had this support meeting that was going on a regular basis, relatively poor attended. And you just, all you did was change the name. And you said, mindfulness and meditation, and suddenly you had big uptake and it was serving the purpose and doing better. Is that a sort of fair, do you think that's a reasonable sort of explanation?
I was gonna say, that's a great summary. Yes, I think that is a good explanation as to why there was that shift. People may be more likely to participate in brief exercises that may not involve as much self-disclosure and having to talk in a group setting, especially when they're so focused on their work in the moment.
So you talk about the resilience room, and you know, it's a physical facility, so available. Were there any challenges around people and the stigma that's associated with coming in? It doesn't sound like it with 20,000 visits. How do you think, why was that? Was it just, I'm in such desperate need? What was going on there? Because my feeling is that there would be I don't want to be seen walking in there. I'm seen as weak, you know, as a typical example.
Yeah. So during the, again, during the height of the pandemic, this space was set up as an employee respite space and a place where people can come, relax. There were beds available since it was a pediatric psych unit. There's also lots of artwork on the walls and showers available if people wanted to shower. As I mentioned, like coffee, tea, snacks available. So you're really working on trying to take care of employees' basic needs and meet their basic needs, which I think may have felt less threatening of a situation to come into. The nurses, again, did an amazing job with going unit to unit, letting people know that this was available, as well as our communications team sending out daily email blasts and making sure that employees were aware that this existed. Really, having boots on the ground was super important. Our nurses, other folks like our physical therapists, occupational therapists, psychologists, and social workers, going to units and letting them know about the resources that we were making available to individuals at the hospital. And so in this, the employee respite area, it was also something that was highly monitored as well by the staff for infection control. And so we made sure that all surfaces were cleaned and people were wearing masks on that unit. So it was really well organized by our nurses. Eventually, there was the need to reopen it as a pediatric unit, given the needs in the community. And our leaders saw how how well utilized the space was and how important it was to the employees. And so they were able to identify a new space, which we recently opened last month, called Resilience at the Brook. And so this resilience room now has is really in the beginning stages, middle stages of development. So we have filled it with different plants and succulents. Again, de-stressing activities like adult coloring books, there's yoga mats. We are in the process of putting up an inspiration exchange wall where employees could take post-its off the wall of inspirational messages, as well as add their own inspirational messages for others. So it's a nice way of having this exchange occur, a sense of giving and receiving. Also having a massage chair available, soothing music. And now those daily mindfulness meditations that we have available virtually, we're now doing as well, offering them in person. So people, we have limited space, of course, due to social distancing, but employees can come into the room, participate in the meditations. They can also participate virtually at the same time for those that can't be in the room. And that the in-person mindfulness work was one of the most highly requested service from the employee respite space during the height of the pandemic. So our nurses had delivered brief surveys to the employees that were coming in to see what services they would like. And in-person mindfulness services was one of the top ones that were requested.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, I think that we've got, you know, another silver lining in all of this. I keep looking for them. And one of them, you know, here is what sounds like a permanent feature now. This is the resilience room at the Brook, which, you know, is now available in the long term. As you think about it going forward in the last couple of minutes, where do you see this going? What are the opportunities? I mean, it seems like this ought to be in every facility in my mind.
That would be amazing. I think we're really looking at how can we bring wellness to the masses at the hospital and across our university and campuses. And so the resilience room is really a central part of this, where we can have programming, potentially yoga, as you had mentioned earlier, these mindfulness sessions, other programming that might become available to really spread wellness education to our employees. For example, like nutrition wellness services, making that available in this space. And then also expanding with, I mentioned the phrase wellness champions of what we named one of the virtual channels, and really trying to have wellness champions for each unit that could be the voice of wellness for that unit and be the eyes and ears to take care of one another and to really help promote that sense of togetherness on the units.
Fantastic. I can't tell you how excited I am about this. I think such an important, you know, activity and contribution to the overall health, not just of the staff, but also, you know, in broader senses, people understand it for themselves. I think it will be easier for them to sort of promote that in the community. So I just remains for me to thank you for joining me today. Thank you for sort of pushing this forward and creating this. Hopefully this will be an inspiration to others to set it up in those in their own facilities. Adam, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.